from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in forums next hour, we'll talk about Baltimore, Ferguson, and the history of U.S. race relations with historian Clarence Walker. He recently won the top prize for teaching and scholarly achievement at UC Davis, where he has taught for nearly 30 years. He was a critic of Afrocentrism during its heyday, a position he argued in his book We Can't Go Home Again, and he'll join us as part of Forum's first-person series profiling the leaders, innovators, and others who make our region unique. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. University of California Davis history professor Clarence Walker joins us in studio for this morning's second hour. He's the author of We Can't Go Home Again, an argument about Afrocentrism, also de-romanticizing black history and mongrel nation, among other books. He's also this year's recipient of the UC Davis Prize for Exceptional Undergraduate Teaching and Scholarship. It's a $45,000 award, and I think that bests just about any other university in the country, which has been given since 1986 to individual faculty as part of Forum's first-person series profiling the leaders, innovators, and others who make our region unique. We welcome Clarence Walker to this morning's second Forum Hour. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to talk to you about Afrocentrism, which certainly gave you a marquee name in terms of scholarship, and get into some of the work you've done along those lines. But first, congratulations, by the way.
Well, thank you.
And let's talk about post-racial society with the election of President Obama. That was a lot of what was bandied around and so forth. You sort of make Afrocentrism into an illusion. Is that an illusion as well?
Well, I think so. I don't think that you have a post-racial society. I think that the recent events in Ferguson and then the shooting of these young black men by police forces around the country would indicate that things have gotten better in some ways, but in other ways they have not. And most certainly in the way the police seem to shoot these young black guys on the streets when they get into confrontations with them.
So we are not necessarily that advanced from where we were with Gunnar Myrdal, a famous Swedish sociologist who said this is an American dilemma?
Well, I think the American dilemma is the American dilemma. I think that you can't understand the United States unless you understand the centrality of race to its evolution and its construction. And I'm not so sure that it was always a dilemma. I think that that was the question of or shall we say the point of view of a foreigner writing about the United States. I think that an American, and certainly a black American, would have argued that it was no dilemma at all.
Well, and then we have W.B. Du Bois, who said the problem with the 20th century is the color line. It's still the problem with the 21st century?
I think so, but I think it's become much more complex than it was. It's no longer a question of just the black people. Now you have Asians and you have Mexican people and you have black people. I tend to think that the whole issue of color is a much more complex and some ways more nuanced way than it was when Du Bois was writing.
Well, I mentioned what I believe was a courageous stand on your part about Afrocentrism. And let's first of all define Afrocentrism for people who may not. I was just teasing the listeners with that. Those of us with longer memory remember it was a big deal.
Yes, it was. And it was a way of rethinking world history and the world by placing Africa rather than Europe at the center of the development of Western civilization and Western culture.
And it was wrong.
Well, I think that it was wrong. I think that, you know, most historical revisionism, particularly of this stripe, is basically I think off the mark in many ways, you know.
You kind of talk about it as a feel-good myth or a catharsis, therapy maybe even.
Yeah, well, in my book I did say that I thought it was really sort of therapeutic and that that what black people needed at the time and what they needed today was not a usable past but a usable present.
And how does Afrocentrism compare, for example, in your mind, to things like Black is Beautiful or Negritude, for that matter? They're all kind of chauvinistic in some ways, aren't they?
Yeah, but I tend to think that in the case of those things, they were sort of necessary. The West has made so much of the malformation of Blackness that you needed something to counteract that. And I think that Negritude, and which is a form of romantic racialism, which is no different than in the 19th century, the British or the French thinking that they were special, those were positive things. And I think that, you know, the Black is Beautiful movement was a positive thing. I love Aretha Franklin's song, Young, Gifted in Black. And I thought that Afrocentrism just went too far. And furthermore, it was, as a historian, it just didn't make sense to me as a historical form of explanation.
That was Aretha Franklin's song. It was also a play by Lorraine Hansberry.
Yes,
aware of. Yeah. So at the time when you were critical of Afrocentrism, there was a sense of how could you be a Black man and be critical of something that was seen as Black, basically?
Well, I think that I think that there's a great tradition of Black critical thought that somehow gets sort of swept to the side, but that it's been there since the 18th century. I mean, if you look at the writings of someone like, Richard Allen, and if you go into the 19th century, Frederick Douglass or Martin Robeson Delaney or any of those people, and Henry McNeil Turner and other Black thinkers, that there is this tradition of Black criticism. And I think that it's not to be just ignored and pushed aside. It's a very important part of the dialogue within the Black community.
I remember when Afrocentrism was very much in vogue, we had people like Leonard Jeffries of CCNY, who was he was president of a Jewish fraternity, and he turned out to be an anti-Semite, but that's a whole other story. But he was very much one of the major advocates of Afrocentrism.
Yeah.
And he was trying to link Black nationalism to Egyptian culture and say that this was really the fountainhead of Afrocentrism because Egyptians were Africans.
Well, they were Africans, but that doesn't mean they were Black.
Precisely my point.
And it seems to me that, you know, the South Africans, the Afrikaners are right to say that they're Africans too, but they're not Black. Is that indeed what is an African or what is a Black person? Is that is a question of debate. I mean, it's not just purely, it seems to me, as Jeffries would have you think, color, you know. It's a bunch of things. It's not just solely that, you know.
We're talking with Clarence Walker, who's professor of history at UC Davis, recipient of their 2015 UC Davis Prize for Undergraduate Teaching and Scholarly Achievement, and also author of many books, including We Can't Go Home Again, An Argument About Afrocentrism, title taken from the great Thomas Wolfe. You grew up here at Berkeley, pretty much. And but then, what, shifted to Texas for a while and then came back?
Well, we went to live in Texas for a year when my mother died, and then we came back, and then I finished school in the Berkeley Public Schools, went to San Francisco State University, and then I completed my PhD at Berkeley.
So Berkeley has been very important in your life, and so has the academic world. And you found through the years, I found this also as a professor quite interesting, students get better?
I think the students have gotten really much better. And I, you know, I'm retiring, but I shall miss these little encounters with the students and the questions they ask. And I mean, you know, the students are pretty savvy today. I mean, they pretty much know BS when they hear it. And they also have, you know, they ask good questions. And, you know, it's really for I'm 73. It's good to have these young people to work with because they sort of keep you alive and sort of alert. And you learn all sorts of things from them that you wouldn't know, you know. But I think, you know, that it's it's been a great career and it's been a great vocation, you know, in the sense that I've learned a lot and I've got to travel a lot. I've gone to Australia to lecture. I've gone to Europe. You know, I've been in Latin America, and so I've been, you know, around the world in many ways.
Yeah. What's it like for an African-American in Davis? It's not exactly a place with great number of African-Americans, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, when I first went there, all my friends said to me, well, of course you're going to live in the Bay Area because there are no black people in Davis. Well, there are a few black people in Davis, and, you know— if I want to be with black people, I can either get on the train and come down to the Bay Area, or my relatives or my friends drive up to see me, you know. And so it's not as though. And then I have a lot of friends in Sacramento, so there's no problem, you know, there. So, but Davis is a pretty white town. It's no getting around that, you know. And
they used to call it a farm town, in fact.
Well, they used to call it a farm town, but it's not a farm town, you know. And, you know, I ride my bike like everybody else, and people know me to be a professor, so I, you know. I have not encountered any really ugliness there with anybody, you know. I mean,
nice to hear. You've also been on a number of occasions. People refer to your strange sense of humor. You've characterized your sense of humor as strange. What do you mean by that?
Well, I have a very ironic sense of humor, and I think it's because I'm a historian. You know, I have what appears to be new to some people is not always new to me, and it's always the case that I can find something to say that is witty or ironic about something. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about more of your work as a historian, because one of the things that you've emphasized, it seems to me, from fairly early on is the idea that that this republic of ours was perhaps founded by a number of white men, but it became quickly, shall we say, more a nation of color.
No, I would say that, and I would say that it was a place of color before the white man arrived. The Native Americans were here, and then the blacks arrived, and then in the 19th century, the Asians and the Indians are here, and so are the, as I said, and then later on, the acquisition or colonization of the western half of the continent brings this enormous Spanish-speaking population into the United States. The United States is not a white nation, I would say, and I'd never say that it was. I would say that it was always a mixed-race space, you know.
You also have a different view of, well, say, for example, what historians have made a great deal out of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Henning. Let's just use that example of mixed races. Sally Henning was a slave of Thomas Jefferson, and the argument goes, he was her lover, and the argument against it says, I'll use that word Gunnar Myrtle used, no, because there was no amalgamation, and therefore it didn't occur.
Well, I think, you know, as one of my essays says, denial is not a river in Egypt. And I think that the point is that Jefferson was part of a particular class of white men who, from the 17th century on, slept with black women or Native American women. And in that sense, he was very much within an American tradition of miscegenation. And I see no reason to hide that. I feel no shame about that or no... you know, I don't think it's just completely outrageous. And the fact that he did it and under the circumstances under which he did it would suggest a deep affection for Sally Hemings and also a certain amount of courage on the part of Jefferson.
But also maybe guilt, too. You know, the psychohistorian W.J. Cash, who wrote Mind of the South, you know that work, where he talks about all the miscegenation that was against supposedly the Christian beliefs of many of these white slave owners, and so they had to have a great deal of guilt and maybe even remorse and their hypocrisy.
Well, I don't know if it was guilt, remorse, or hypocrisy. I think that's wishful thinking. I think that...
More denial?
More denial. And I think it's a way of, you know, just sort of trying to prettify something that doesn't require prettification. You know, people are attracted to people regardless of their color, you know, or their gender or whatever, you know.
I like that word, prettification.
Yeah.
We're talking to Clarence Walker, professor of history at UC Davis. And there is a sense of a lot of history being made, and present history included, by the media? I mean, it was made certainly in Jefferson's day. It's still made in this day.
Well, I think so. I tend to think that a lot of things get manufactured and become part of the public discourse that historians would be skeptical of because there's not evidence for it, but it's just something that's popular and something that people want to believe, you know.
Is that maybe the post-racial idea?
Well, I think the post-racial idea is pretty much what I would call a chimera. It's an illusion.
Give us other examples that come to mind of those media-made chimeras, if you will.
Take me a minute to think about that, but it's...
Well, how about Obama himself?
I mean, well, I tend to think that that was, you know, we wrote, my student Greg Smithers and I wrote that book about Obama and the election. And I think that that was pretty much a feel-good moment in the history of the American Republic. I think that President Obama has struggled against forces that... he did not anticipate, or if he did anticipate, I don't think that he thought that they would be as forceful as they have been. And I think that, you know, the United States hasn't had a president who didn't have problems since the time of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I think that, you know, that Harry Truman faced a lot of problems. We know Dwight Eisenhower faced problems, and certainly both of the Bushes. But I think that Obama's have been really, in some ways, out of control. And I think it has, in some ways, to do with the racial nature of the United States.
Well, when the election began and pretty much was underway, there was all of this media talk and writing about Reverend Wright and about his influence on President Obama?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, no one wrote in the same way about Billy Graham and his influence on white presidents. I mean, you know, Reverend Wright is a great preacher, and he was a person of enormous stature in the black church community of Chicago. And much of what he said may have been new to white people, but it wasn't new to black people. And much of what he said about some things, you know, was controversial. And I didn't always agree with it, but...
I don't think Billy Graham ever said, "God damn America," though. Which Reverend
Yeah, but I think that Billy
occasions.
Graham is not a black person.
No, no, but you were making the analogy of
yeah.
Graham and Reverend Wright.
Yeah, but I think, you know, that Billy Graham was a great preacher, but... I think that, you know, other people, black people, have said worse things about the United States. And so, I mean, I was not surprised or shocked by this.
You had, on one occasion, speculated about what if President Obama had had a white father and a black mother?
Yes.
And flesh that out a little bit in terms of what you wanted people to think about.
Well, how maybe his reception might have been different. And that the fact that he had a white mother really sort of raised people's, I think, eyebrows and things like that. But I think that if it's a man, it's an entirely different thing. If he's the progenitor, if it's a white father, that it's a different thing in some ways. You know?
Do you think black America is still, some would maybe make this thesis viable, still split up the way it was between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, that we see that maybe even in Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, those kind of divisions or binaries?
Well, no. I think that those binaries are there, but I think they've taken on a different sort of salience and a different sort of well, I think they have a different meaning. I think that the Washington-Du Bois conflict is a particular problem of the late 19th, the first part of the 20th century. I think the issues that they were talking about in some ways, those issues still obtain in many ways, but I think that they're not articulated in the same ways that they were.
You know? Can I give you another binary just to get your reaction? Because I remember reading Harold Cruse's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual.
A great book.
It is a great book, and he says there's a material culture and a spiritual culture for African Americans. Still pretty much the case, that binary?
I think so. I think it's true of the nation as a whole.
Would agree with that, too. You've expressed some interest in writing about, or maybe you've lectured about, the way blacks appear in movies, particularly in slavery?
Yeah, I'm interested in a lot of these movies. The last one that I really sort of perked my interest was Django. I thought that that was an interesting amalgam of several genres, the Western, the plantation, and then the buddy movie, you know? And so I would like to write something about those kinds of films.
What would you say about those kinds of films?
Well, I think they speak to a present day mentality. I think that they're very much a product of the late 20th, the 21st century, and that it's kind of inconceivable that those could have been made earlier. And if they were, they were, I thought, well, I think that they still draw on a number, that Django still draws on a number of stereotypes, but I think that it's nothing like that I can remember beforehand that was very good. And if it was, it was all these sort of blaxploitation films that had black and white characters in the lead and things like that.
Mm. It's been really a fascinating evolution, though, when you think about it. I mean, I was thinking the other day about how Native Americans were portrayed to such a negative degree that Marlon Brando refused to take a Academy Award and sent up Sasheen Littlefeather.
Yes.
And then you think of Birth of a Nation and how far we've come. And you think of Kevin Costner making his movie which is much more favorable in the portrayal of Native Americans. I mean, we've come a long way, and we've come a long way, particularly when you think about statutes and Jim Crow and so forth. And yet I think you've gone on record as saying, especially when you think about all the young blacks who are in prison and young blacks being unarmed and shot and so forth, we haven't come very far at all.
Well, I think that that is true. I think that in that realm that there's still – I mean, the police in some ways seem to think that the only way they can deal with these insurgent young black men is by shooting them. And I was hopeful that there would be some other way that this could be dealt with.
But is that so racial? For example, in Baltimore, you have 67% of the population black. You have a black mayor. You have black police officers who've been charged and so forth.
Well, it may be a question of class. It's not necessarily solely a question of race. But I think that in America, wherever you have any sort of tensions between black and white specifically, that it will always be read as race, you know.
You know about what just happened in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Yes.
You have a couple of white officers shot by blacks.
Yeah.
I mean, to a great degree, especially when you think about a state like Mississippi and its history, this is all pretty scary stuff as it continues to combust.
I know. Well, I tend to think that there's been this illusion or that all of this stuff had gone away. And I don't think that it has gone away. I think it's just sort of percolating, you know, the surface of the everyday. And I think certainly in terms of these cities, the relationship of the police to these minority communities is still very much a difficult one.
Again, our guest this hour is Professor Clarence Walker, professor of history at UC Davis and recipient of this year's UC Davis Prize for Undergraduate Teaching and Scholarly Achievement, and the author of many books. Let me, most notably, We Can't Go Home Again, an argument about Afrocentrism. I say most notably because I think that really did put you on the map, didn't it?
That and the Deromanticizing Black History book.
Let's bring our listeners into this conversation. Lots to talk about here, and we're talking about lots of things, but we certainly welcome your involvement in the conversation and invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, so feel free to join the program with questions or comments or whatever's on your mind in relationship to the topics that we're talking about here. Again, that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also join us by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. I'd like to hear from you, though, and like you to join us. Again, Clarence Walker, our guest, professor of history at UC Davis. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with UC historian, UC Davis historian Clarence Walker, who got a $45,000 prize. And as I said, I think that bests any university for undergraduate teaching and scholarly achievement. And he got a faux check that they presented him. He's assuming that it will be in the bank and the check will be good. I want to ask, we'll go to our callers in just a moment, though. Actually, ask you about the movie Gone with the Wind, because we were talking a little bit about that movie off air. I know you've had an interest in it for quite some time and think it's a great American movie.
Oh, yeah, I do think it's a great American movie because it's a movie that suggests to Americans in the wake of the Depression that there was a time when there was a world that was not riven by conflict where there was some kind of they don't really talk about slavery, but the race relations are made to be more, shall we say, harmonious than they really should be. And also, I just tend to think, you know, the whole place of women in that movie, of Scarlett and Mammy and some of the other strong female characters in the movie, really sort of make it an interesting American cinematographic experience.
There would be some concern, though, probably by other black historians or black movie critics about the portrayal of characters like Mammy or the Butterfly McQueen character, that these are too stereotypical.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think that's true. But I tend to think that this is what one would have to expect of a cinema, of an American movie industry of the 1930s and, you know, the early 1940s. I mean, they were not going to put people up on the screen who contradicted the public opinion of black people, the white public opinion of black people. You know, I mean, it's not, I think it would be ahistorical to think that. You know.
What would you think about, speaking of ahistorical and movies, about Selma? I mean, we had some conversation on it, and many people found it quite moving, but there was a great deal of concern that Lyndon Baines Johnson was made into far more of a villain than he actually was, because he was pretty much with King on voting rights, and that I've heard complaints about the fact that clergymen were represented, but they were Christian. There were no Jewish clergymen, though there were many, certainly, in Selma.
Well, I think that's true, that there were not there was not a representation of the variety of people in the clergy who participated in the civil rights movement, and certainly would be true of the numerous, of the many Jewish rabbis and others who went and marched with King. I thought the movie, as movies go, was a very good movie. I enjoyed it a lot, and I thought that the portrayal of King was very well done by David Oyelowo.
Would you, Tavis Smiley, who's a friend and well-known talk show host on TV and radio, has said to me on a couple of occasions he thinks there's no other figure to even rival Martin Luther King in terms of the effect and the impact on the 20th century history in America. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that he had a profound effect on this country, far more so than
even our presidents?
Well, I think so, but I think more so than maybe Johnson or Kennedy and the people who have come after them, including Obama. I think that this was a moment of a protean change. I mean, what he wanted to do was really significant in terms of the history of the American Republic and the way he went about it. I don't see how you could have accomplished as much as he accomplished if there hadn't been some kind of commitment to nonviolence.
We go to our callers, and we go first to you, Joe. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. First of all, I want to say thanks for having this author on. I did read Deromanticizing Black History, and I really appreciated your reference to Marcus Garvey and saying how he actually didn't like light-skinned black people very much. And it was interesting that the Rastafarian movement places so much emphasis on him. Even Bob Marley didn't seem to know that, being a light-skinned black person, that perhaps Marcus Garvey wouldn't have liked him. But the other comment I wanted to really talk to was the comment that the people in Baltimore, the officers, were black. And I think oftentimes when we get into race discussions, it gets tense, and then people talk about class. And that kind of takes, you know, it may be a legitimate issue up to a certain point, but I think it lets people off the hook sometimes. And so I just want to make that comment that sometimes we go too quick to the issue of class, and then, you know, all of a sudden we don't really discuss the issue.
Let me hear from you on this, Clarence Walker.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you about that. I saw, you know, in the paper that several of the officers involved in the Baltimore thing were black officers. I didn't know that before I saw their pictures. I think that the fact that they were black does not in any way, you know, exempt them from criticism or from if there's any sort of judicial evaluation of this, that they, if they did something wrong, that they should be held liable for it. And that's all I'll say.
And let me thank the caller. The caller mentioned Marcus Garvey, a name that's not necessarily familiar to all of our listeners. He was head of something called the United Negro
Improvement Association.
And they would march through Harlem, and they'd have epaulettes, and they'd have uniforms, and basically it was a Pan-African movement.
Yes.
Did the Pan-African movements like that really lead to the Afrocentrism? Is there a link there in your mind?
Well, I think they draw on the same tradition of thinking about Africa as a space in a homeland where black people can live with dignity. No, absolutely.
And we go to more of our callers. We go next to Scott in Palo Alto. Good morning.
Good morning. The other day I was reading this book by Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he indicated or proposed that in order to kind of live free, people must think freely. And in order to think freely, you've got to be in constant revolt of the traditions and beliefs of that make you up and the groups that you belong to. So we're all, you know, we're all Americans, we're all Californians, we live in this area. And then as we get to the groups that are closer to us, we ourselves as individuals form like the smallest group that we belong to. So my question to you, sir, is what is your perception of what does the black community of such a group exist? What fundamental beliefs do they need to be in constant revolt in of not just of people external to them, but what of their own beliefs of themselves? Seems like Martin Luther King challenged the beliefs of people outside of his so-called group, but he also challenged the beliefs of his fellow marchers and saying, you know, we're not powerless. We actually do have power. Am I making any sense there?
Oh, yeah, I think you're making sense. I don't know if you're in revolt, or, but I tend to think that everybody should be engaging in a process of self-criticism and of criticism of the society in which they live constantly, that one can't be, you know, I think completely accepting of the world as it is, that it's important that you think about alternatives and that you think broadly about those alternatives.
We thank you for the call. Do you think, I mean, black nationalism here in the United States had a pretty strong element to it. I'm thinking not only about, I'm thinking particularly about thinkers and writers like Baraka, Leroy Jones. And it was so strong that there was a sense we want to separate from white people and we don't want anything to do with white people, that sort of thing. Has that played out? Is that just a phasic thing, do you think? Or?
Well, I think it's a thing that comes and goes. I don't think it's played out, but I don't think that it's as powerful, as appealing as it was. And certainly the election of a black president would suggest, you know, that Baraka and some of those people basically, I think, misconstrued in some ways the feelings of a substantial portion of the black population in this country.
We get back to Reverend King, too, who didn't think there could be a black president in his lifetime or even beyond.
Well, you know, I didn't either.
So something did there was a was kind of a watershed with the election of Barack Obama racially?
Well, yeah, I'd say there's a watershed. I'd say that it has not necessarily resulted in the new kingdom. I think that there have been some changes, but I tend to think that there's still
You okay, Clarence? Mm. Need some water? Clinics. I think there's some right by there, right there for you.
Clinics.
Kleenex, if we could.
I say that Barack Obama is a step in the right direction. I don't think that it's an end or
Okay, we're going to get you some Kleenex. In the meantime, let me read some emails here. Tim writes, Michael just said two white police officers were shot in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. One was white, the other black. Thank you for that, if I misspoke. Ben writes, Ann writes, it seems to me that the high level of skills contributed by slaves, making it possible to run the essentially self-sufficient households and economies of plantations, is rarely mentioned or portrayed in the media.
It's skilled not portrayed in the media, but it's portrayed in history books.
Yeah, well, I think this is the point that Ann makes. Skilled carpentry, farming, weaving, barrel making, soap and candles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But no one teaching the history of the American Republic, and particularly the period from roughly the 17th century up through the Civil War, would ignore the fact that the slave population particularly in Virginia and in the Carolinas, in the 17th and the 18th century were a highly skilled population, that those skills seem to evaporate with the development of the Cotton Kingdom, where you basically need a much more proletarian workforce and a skilled one to pick the cotton.
And where you have much more machinery.
And you also have some machinery, absolutely. Yeah. But it seems to me that great books on slavery, like Peter Wood's Black Majority or Gerald Mullen's book on slavery in Virginia, or some of the other books that have come in the last 20 years on slavery, have argued for the skilled nature of the slave population.
Where do you stand on this argument that seems perennial? Some would say, you know, slavery still has major culpability for so many of the problems that are going on in urban areas today, and for example, in black neighborhoods and black poverty. And then there are others who say, you know, slavery happened a long time ago. it's been transcended, would be the other side of that argument.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's been transcended. I think that's a bit foolish. But I would say that it does have deep roots in America in terms of the nature of American structural inequality, that black people were the only people in the history of the American Republic who were slaves, and that there are consequences for that, both in terms of their mobility and their access to opportunity and a number of other things in the society, and particularly historically, the question of education, and that this is not something that has gone away. I mean, where you have a problem as structural, as deeply structural as slavery, it doesn't evaporate, overnight, and it'd take, a long time for this to go away.
So you've read Michelle Alexander's work, I presume, all those black prisoners, there's
yes.
a tie
yeah.
to slavery.
Yeah. I must confess that I've looked in that book. I haven't read it systematically.
Well, she certainly makes the umbilical connection. Let me get another caller on. Damien, join us. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi.
So I've heard about you, Professor Clarence, from a good friend of mine who goes to Davis. Her name is Deborah McCracken. We started the Black Student Union here at the Santa Rosa Junior College. But respectfully, I would like to say that I think that it is rather absurd that a professor of your stature doesn't think that Afrocentrism is essential to African-Americans in this country moving forward and getting themselves out of the rut that they're in. When you think about people, Pan-Africanists like Marcus Garvey, who garnered the largest movement of Africans and African-Americans across this planet, he did that by using Afrocentrism. When you think about the systematic oppression that is going on in the educational system, where in the educational system for a white kid, he learns that the father of sciences is Alexander Newton, the father of philosophy is Socrates, and Abraham Lincoln didn't lie, and all of the people on the money are white men. So they grow up, they come up out of the educational system feeling a sense of superiority. And as a black kid, you go to the school, and who do you learn about? Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And what happened to them? So we need something in place to build our self-esteem, to give us that sense of empowerment, to give us something that we can identify with. And I just wanted to point out, as far as when it comes to offices in the Baltimore, even though some of those were colored, we have to try not to look at situations where individual officers kill unarmed black men and point at that officer and automatically say, okay, he's racist, because we don't know if that officer is racist, white or black. But what we do know is the criminal justice system is inherently prejudiced and is inherently racist. So if police officers are just there to enforce the law that is based on the criminal justice system that is inherently prejudiced and racist, then by nature, by default, the officers that enforce that law are going to be prejudiced. So we just got to try to move away from, again, pointing fingers at individuals' offices. And when it comes to movies, I just want to point out one last thing. Those stereotypical images are still being reinforced for movies like Exodus, where they're talking about Egypt and all of the kings and the queens are white and the underlings and the slaves are black, to movies like Precious, where you still have the updated version of the mammy. Where is the movies about the Haitian Revolution and the Toussaint L'Ouverture? Where's the feature films about the Nat Turner revolt in the United States of America? They do not want to give us those images because they know how powerful those images are, and they know what it can do to the subconsciousness of African-Americans in the United States.
Now, Damien, you make a number of points and make them gusto, if I may say so. Let me hear what Professor Walker has to say.
Well, yeah, I would say that, you know, you make a number of points, but my basic analysis of this is not as yours. I see the problems of Black Americans as structural, not therapeutic. And I don't think that movies and those sorts of things are going to turn around poverty and social inequality in this country.
And you say what, Damien?
Well, that's why I disagree with him, because movies in this country have been long time used as propaganda tools to manipulate people's mind. When you guys talked about Birth of a Nation earlier, that took the KKK's ranks from 10,000 to 100,000 overnight. So what are you talking about? I think that you're a little bit, respectfully, my man, you're a little bit older, so I think you're disconnected from the energy that the African-American youth in this country is possessing. And right now, the youth and the African-American youth in this country is all about Afrocentrism. It's all about Pan-Africanism. And that is our only way out of this struggle. African-Americans in this country will not be free until Africa is free. Until Africa as a continent is liberated, Africans across the diaspora, we will not never be free.
Damien, what do you I'm just curious to know, you speak quite eloquently in favor of Afrocentrism and freedom, but many of those former colonies are now ruled by blacks. Zimbabwe comes pretty easily to mind, or Uganda, and they don't have freedom.
Yeah,
Sudan, of course, too. I mean, I could go through a whole list of them.
Of course we can, but we have to be honest about what we're talking about. We know that Africans do not own or control Africa. We know that majority of Africa is owned by Europeans. So we have to be honest about our perception about when it comes to African leaders in Africa. We know that at the end of the day, they don't own and control nothing. Majority of Africa is owned and controlled by Europeans. And at the end of the day, I think that...
I don't think you can say that about Zimbabwe. I mean, they pretty much took away most of the European landowning and other power in that country. And, you know, it's happened in other African countries as well. Let me thank you, Damien, for the call. I want to actually go back to Professor Walker. Do you feel there's a division between you and young African Americans?
No, I teach them all the time, and we seem to get along. We have, I give my students the right to disagree, and I disagree with what they have to say, and they disagree with what I have to say, you know. And so there's no, I think, you know, that there is a generational gap, but I also think there's a knowledge gap.
Well, it's surprising to hear Damien, who sounds, you know, quite thoughtful, say that Afrocentrism is still very much a part, maybe a building block even for youth, for black youth.
Well, I haven't seen that for some time. I mean, I'd say 10 years ago, yeah, but I'd say in the last 5 or 6 years, I've not seen a lot of black undergraduates who were Afrocentric. They mostly seem to be largely concerned with getting their education so they can get a job.
Let's talk about that. I mean, it goes back again to what I brought up before about the Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois debate. Washington felt black people had to be trained and they had to have jobs to move up economically. And I guess Du Bois put more emphasis to some extent on that talented 10th.
But he also put more emphasis, I think, than in a way that Washington could not, on politics. I think that the difference between the two is that they both wanted the same thing, but they came at it from different perspectives. And I think that, you know, that the argument that Washington had given up on the vote is not true. I mean, as Louis Harland and other biographers of Washington pointed out, that Washington was secretly financing in the 1890s campaigns in the South to get black people the right to vote and supporting people who were trying to get the franchise.
Somebody once said to me, an African-American scholar who will remain unnamed, that Washington was a little like Brer Rabbit.
Well, no, I think that he was a very smart guy who worked from within in a way that was truly phenomenal for a black man of the time. I mean, to be sure, I think he had this public persona. But then if he'd been much more overt and upfront about things, I think that he would not have had the support that he garnered from people like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller and others.
Still a lightning rod, though, for many black nationalists who say, you know, he was walking around the Rose Garden.
And, I mean, many black nationalists like Washington for the simple reason that Washington, they read as being somebody calling for an independent black economy.
Black leaders... People often come up with the names Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton. How do you see them?
Well, spokesmen. I don't know if they're leaders.
Speaking for the people generally, or speaking for religious people, or speaking for...
Well, I think they articulate quite well in some cases a great deal of the ongoing grievances of black people.
We don't seem to have young people necessarily with that kind of luminary marquee name among African Americans, do we?
No, I don't think so.
You know why that might? There may be a generation gap there too, perhaps?
I think there's a generation gap. And I also think there are different concerns too.
What would the concerns be, do you think, of the younger people now?
I think the concerns today are basically getting a job and getting ahead and establishing themselves in society. And, you know, most of the students I teach want to be professionals. They want to be lawyers or doctors or something like that. And they're not terribly political. I mean, they're generally, this is a generation of people, regardless of its color, that's not very political. It's not like the 60s.
Well, I'm looking at an online comment here about how the Internet has changed the plight of the African-American as perceived by the general public and maybe even our understanding of black history. But I also want to remind you that you are listening to Forum and we're talking with Clarence Walker, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go to John next. John, thanks for waiting.
Good morning. This has been a great program, Michael, and your guest is very articulate and interesting. I've been pleased with the issue of police oppression against black people has finally been given the attention it is needed, including by the news media and protest marches. There is, however, a significant problem of black-on-black crime that I read about almost daily in the newspaper and on various media. My question is, should the black community, including black leaders such as your guest, Al Sharpton and Willie Brown, be doing more to address this issue?
Well, I'm not a black leader. I'm just a black academic. And of course they should. And I think that they do. I think that, these people speak out a lot about these sorts of issues, and particularly about this black-on-black crime issue, and that it's just an ongoing thing. And I'm not so sure how it's going to come to an end and how it's going to be transformed.
Let me thank the caller, and let's go to another caller. Dan, that's you. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I just wanted to reference earlier you had made mention, you'd raised the question if the disparities of wealth and the problems in the inner cities and things like Baltimore were a legacy of slavery or if that had gone. And there was no mention made of, top-down laws like redlining and the FHA and how they, basically the ghetto was created. There's a lot that went on in the 20th century that was actual policy that came from the government.
Well, I did say that I thought it was structural, and that's what I was referring to.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to hear if maybe you talk about that a little more.
No, I tend to think that a lot of that stuff, like redlining and the nature of restrictive covenants and just the whole way suburbs were constructed with exclusionary clauses for blacks and for in some cases, initially Asians and Spanish-speaking people, even Jews and Catholics at one time, that all of these things work to contribute to some kind of deep structural inequality in the United States. And that continues with respect to black people in many ways that it doesn't continue to affect others in the society.
Dan, we thank you for the call. Here's Joe who writes, I take issue with Professor Walker comparing non-black Egyptians with white South Africans who were originally Northern Europeans and not indigenous to Africa. Egyptians, like Africans in the northern region of Africa, are comprised of a range of phenotypes that are all indigenous to Africa. The problem has been with the efforts to extricate Egypt from Africa, not the proper effort by historians to reclaim Egypt from Europe.
Yes and no. But when I said that, I was just giving voice to the white South African point of view that they are Africans. And from the fact that they've been there since the 17th century, I would agree that they are African.
And we'll bring another caller on, and that's you, George. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Yes. I just want to bring up and point out that racism in this country is not simply a white versus black. It's more equal opportunity. It seems like every every race of color becomes a victim of racism. And the most recent example is in the New York Times last week about a Chinese woman that worked exemplary performance for the U.S. government on predicting flooding on the Ohio River. She was suddenly arrested, humiliated, chained and handcuffed in front of her coworkers. And then a few weeks later, I think all charges were dismissed. But in the meantime, she's out of a job and her reputation is ruined. And this kind of thing happens all the time, dating back from the most famous case was the Wen Ho Lee case. And, you know, I guess Asians and Chinese in particular don't go around throwing rocks in windows and burning cars and doing other things to call attention to the injustice.
Well, Professor Walker makes the point on a number of occasions that America has its racial problems that cover all races. In fact, I think you've talked about the fact
that... Well, I teach this course that does that, yeah. So I don't really find this comment edifying in any way.
In fact, things are going to change from your perspective. You are getting a little bit crystal ball here, but just on the basis of demographics, because more Hispanic is taking greater numbers.
Absolutely. I think that the nature of race in America is being transformed, and that the issue in this century will be the question of Spanish-speaking people and not necessarily the great focus that it has been on blacks as it was in the last century.
Clarence Walker, we thank you. Again, congratulations on being the recipient of this year's UC Davis Prize for undergraduate teaching and scholarly achievement. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you very much.
And appreciate you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.